All right, Tim, thanks for joining us. I know there was a scarce availability of NBA media members on this night, but glad to have you here. Let's always talk some
basketball. Yeah, always happy to come on, Nate. I didn't mean to cut you off, but always happy to come on and a good distraction today, so this will be fun.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, so the big game of the day was Hawks and Cavs, Atlanta returning to their personal house of horrors with yeah. a new team. Dwight Howard hopefully was going to change things for them. And they ended up winning, even without Kyle Korver. Pretty impressive. Do you think, based on this win, which was a 110-106 victory for the Hawks, do you feel any better about their chances of potentially competing with Cleveland in a playoff series?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think you said no on Twitter, and I tended to agree with you that they still are going to struggle, I think, to guard, particularly when Channing Frye played. You know, they didn't make a lot of the shots they were getting, but Cleveland was still getting a ton of great looks. But, you know, I kind of thought from the start of the summer that the switch from Al Horford to Dwight Howard wasn't going to be as big of a screw up to what the Hawks were doing as people might have thought, just because, not that Al isn't a great player, I think he is, but you know, Horford isn't a great rebounder and wasn't a great rim protector, and Dwight, even at this point in his career, even if he's not quite what he was, he's still an excellent rebounder and can be a force at the rim. And you know, even though when the Cavs played small, they were able to get him away from the basket, you know, he still had 17 rebounds and 3 blocked shots tonight. And those are the kind of numbers they weren't getting before. And it does give, well, I don't think they're really any closer to being better than the Cavs. I think it does give Atlanta a different dimension overall that they didn't have, that I think, you know, going forward and once they get into the playoffs could allow them to be a little better than they were before.
Yeah, at least they might lose to him in a different way.
Right.
You know, and granted, the Hawks did not have Korver in this game. He helps certainly on offense. Probably they're a little bit better defensively, starting Bazemore and Cephalosha against LeBron James.
Right.
But I thought that Dwight was very effective when he was in, and also when Tristan Thompson was in. Thompson did not score, did not even attempt a shot, get a single offensive
Thompson.
Rebound.
He bossed Thompson the whole game.
Yeah, Thompson was negative 14 in his 25 minutes. And the reason for that, too, was the Cavs, whether it was Irving or James, they're usually able to beat the Cavs or beat the Hawks to the basket, and the Hawks didn't have a ton of rim protection before they got Howard. With Howard in, and you know, he did miss some time in the first quarter after he had to get stitches, but when he was in, you could tell he was in LeBron's head. Those post-ups that came so easily didn't work that well, and Thompson wasn't able to make himself available for passes. But then, of course, things really changed when Cleveland went to either Kevin Love or Channing Frye at center, and that was able to take Howard out of the game.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I referenced it before, but I was watching that stretch. I think it was in the fourth quarter when the Cavs were coming back, and even though they didn't quite win the game in the end, you know, Kyrie had 2 or 3 wide open shots that he missed. They just kept moving the ball around and getting wide open shots, and they just didn't make a few of them, and that wound up being the difference. But it is kind of remarkable. I was thinking about it watching this game that, you know, Channing Frye's a good player, but it is kind of amazing that move wound up being one of the most consequential moves in a while, that they went and got him last year at the deadline. You know, getting him from Orlando, it unlocked that lineup with the Cavs where you just have all 5 of those guys out there who can bomb threes, and it really has made them, you know, when you run that group out there, you know, there's very few teams that can line up with them and cause them trouble defensively then.
Yeah, they elected to have Howard actually guard Kevin Love, and what finally caused Coach Bud to take him out of the game, I mean, Howard only had 4 fouls, but with about 5 minutes left, Love faked a 3 and got Howard in the air. And I think really Love had been 0-for-4 at that time from 3. I think that you still want to leave Howard out there in that situation, you know, because they were going basically with Millsap at center at that point. And that they scored well enough to hold the Cavs off, even though the Cavs, even once Howard was out, they're still getting great shots, because then you can just go to LeBron in the post and you're going to force help anyway and have open threes regardless of whether you have Howard out there or not. So I think Howard just has to get a little bit better at closing out on Love, and maybe that's the guy that you're going to live with. I mean, Love is a good 3-point shooter, but he's not like an unbelievable knockdown guy. You know, he's going to shoot 36-37% usually. So I think that's probably probably the strategy there. But again, I think what we really have to go back to, other than the fact that things look better from a structural standpoint for the Hawks, they just shot incredibly well. Schroeder, 3 out of 6 on threes. He was 10 out of 16. Bazemore was 4 out of 6.
Kyrie, not much of a speed bump for Schroeder tonight, getting to the basket, though. Kyrie did have 29 on 27 shots, but I mean, Schroeder's just getting wherever he wanted all game.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then the Cavs got up 42 three-pointers. You know, and they shot 26%. Like, this is a great team. Smith was 2 out of 10. Kyrie, 1 out of 7. Love, 0 for 4. I mean, those are really good three-point shooters, and they were getting whatever looks they wanted to. And so when you give up 42 three-point shots to a team, generally your defense isn't that good. And they still gave up a buck 6 to the Hawks, although it was at kind of a faster pace than we normally see between these two teams. So again, I think Schroeder is going to be very hard pressed to repeat that performance, hitting threes when they're going under on the pick and roll. Bazemore, same thing. And so and then the Cavs had so many shots rimming it out too, even during that decisive time when LeBron was out of the game. Kyrie had a couple that just hit like five parts of the rim and bounced out. So I don't think that this is like, oh, the Hawks are definitely going to be better than the Cavs now, or even that they're going to come close to being in the playoffs just because the shooting was so in the Hawks' favor this game.
No, I agree with you on that. And it is funny too, you look at the box score, like the Hawks had 19 turnovers and turned into 25 Cavs points. Cavs shot more free throws. Like, you know, you kind of look at the box score and it is kind of hard to see how Cleveland didn't win this game. But I do think one thing that this game shows, at least to me, is that I thought Atlanta was probably going to finish the season as the fourth best team in the East, at least in the regular season. And this game, I think, does kind of back that up for me. I think they're still going to be, you know, probably that team right after Cleveland, Boston, and Toronto, which will likely mean that they, you know, either play, you know, some team like Detroit that maybe could give them trouble if they're healthy in the first round and then get blown out by the Cavs in round two again. But, you know, to your point, I think, you know, they may lose a little different. And I think it may be a little bit more competitive now just because of the fact that Dwight does offer a little bit different dimension. But I'm with you. I don't exactly see them as a threat at this point.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to digging into the Hawks a little bit further when I do the 15 and 60 on the Eastern Conference over the weekend, because I do want to assess the possibility that they might even be as good as the second best team in the East, frankly, with how things have gone. And their defense has in large part been excellent aside from this game.
Yeah, number two, I think, in the league, right?
Yeah, I want to say.
Behind the Clippers, I think. I'll look that up while we're talking.
Yeah, no, that was right. Going into today, I think that was the case. And they also, I think, had the best net rating in the league, at least recently, probably not after this game now. A couple of notes here. Down the end, the Cavs were down 5. The Hawks made some amazing, you know, tough twos to keep scoring. I mean, that was really their only hope. They had to just keep scoring because they weren't stopping the Cavs on the other end. And so with about 30 seconds left or so, the Cavs drew up a great out-of-bounds play where they're able to lob it to LeBron, basically when he was fronted under the rim. They brought everybody over to the strong side from the sideline out-of-bounds, threw it to him. And that was, I usually abhor the quick two, but with 30 seconds left, they had enough time to defend at that point. And then LeBron actually missed the layup. And I think it was Love got the offensive rebound. He got fouled and he was able to make he actually got the and one, I think, on the inbounds play after Schroeder didn't help on a back cut.
Right.
And so that actually put him within two. And then at that point, there was some odd decisions from Atlanta, but they happened to work out.
As the night went on, I think this became a theme. Just very odd decisions all over the place late in games. It was not teams not covering themselves in glory over and over again.
Well, so there was like a 1 second differential. The Cavs announcer's like, oh, you don't need a foul. Like, of course you need to foul.
Yeah, that was insane. I had no idea what they were talking about.
Well, they did at least trap, and I think going for a trap, going for the steal at first is useful there, but then, you know, maybe you foul later. And they did actually force the Hawks to go early, and I didn't force them, but kind of rattled them into doing it. And then Bazemore just had a not an easy 18 footer on the baseline that he drained to put him up 4 and end the game. But they did kind of get what they wanted there to get him to go early. It just, the Hawks actually made the shot.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. If you're in a situation where you have to foul, I like it when teams do trap. Both because a lot of times teams don't expect it. They just kind of expect a foul. And hey, I mean, if you can get a steal and not give a team free throws, then great, right? I mean, that's kind of what you're trying to do. But then, you know, then it, the ideal scenario is if you trap and it doesn't work, then you foul a couple seconds later and it's not, you don't waste too much time. But yeah, it just, like you said, you know, you have to kind of give Bazemore credit that he knocked down a pretty tough shot. And even though Cleveland got what they wanted, it wound up not working out.
Last thing on this game, we would be remiss in not mentioning the greatest moment that Mike Muscala will ever have in his entire career.
Bucknell's finest.
He came in from the left baseline. LeBron was on him. LeBron didn't box him out. And he had a one-hand tip dunk off of 1 foot over both LeBron and Tristan Thompson. Ended up actually running into, I think it was Cephalosha, and like falling on his butt and actually hurting himself.
Yes.
But it was just, I mean, one of like the greatest dunks by an American white guy that we've seen in like the last 2 years.
It was easily. An amazing play. Amazing play. I was afraid Muscala had killed himself on it, but I had the same reaction you did. I was like, whoa, came absolutely out of nowhere.
Yeah. It's pretty everyone impressive. Is mad at American white males today, but that is one thing that we we don't have to be angry at American white males.
That's true because
that dunk was awesome. All right, let's get to your old stomping grounds here.
Yes, Brooklyn Nets streaking.
Yeah, what do you make of the fact that this team actually has like looked pretty decent? They're 3-4. They won this game. I foretold disaster for them when Lynn and Vasquez are both going to be out for a couple of weeks.
Me too. I mean, they're playing. I mean, I'm sure people are not paying attention to the Brooklyn Nets, and I don't blame them. I haven't paid that much attention either.
They're playing entertaining ball right now.
No, they're playing great. I think you have to give Kenny Atkinson just an unbelievable amount of credit. I think in a similar way, and I know we're going to talk about the Lakers later, and you know, you and Danny really, I thought, got to this very, very nicely on the 15 and 60 the other day on the West. But you know, if you look at the Nets, I mean, Kenny Atkinson, new coach there, came from Atlanta, had been in New York in a bunch of spots, really highly respected assistant coach. He's got everybody buying in. And he's playing 9 or 10. He's playing 10 guys a night, basically. If you look around the league, you know, we have gotten mad at Steve Kerr at times for his Kumbaya Kerr stuff, which, you know, when it's game seven of the finals, you're playing Anderson Varejao, not ideal. But I do think if you are able to play everybody on your roster, even if it's not every game, but you give guys opportunities to play, and you move the ball around and everybody gets shots, you know, guys are willing to buy in and work hard then. And this Nets team obviously isn't that great from a skill standpoint, but he's got them working really hard. And, you know, look, they've got some guys that can score, right? I mean, Brook Lopez has always been able to score. Now he shot 7 threes today. I think in the entire time I covered him, he shot 2 or 3 total. He shot 7 in this game. He made 3. You know, Bojan Bogdanović makes 3 threes. Like they go 12 for 33 from 3. I think they're getting a lot more threes up, and they're just kind of pushing the pace and forcing the other team to do stuff. But I think this game, you know, probably says a lot more about Minnesota than it does the Nets, given the Nets played Isaiah Whitehead 26 minutes at point guard and don't have another point guard on the roster and still were able to win this game.
Yeah, and I think a good way to transition from what the Nets are doing to the Wolves is the Nets shot chart today. 23 of 32 in the restricted area. That is a ton of shots in the restricted area. And then they also took 33 threes, as you mentioned. That left only 11 shots on twos outside the restricted area. And that is just a very good offensive performance in terms of shot selection. And the difference between them and these Philly teams that had very good shot selection but just didn't actually make any shots and had horrible offensive efficiencies is, while these guys are very limited from a creation standpoint, they have guys who can shoot the ball. And Bojan, even a Joe Harris, Kilpatrick, Justin Hamilton, he was took 4 shots. All of them were threes. He made 3 of them. Lopez is popping out.
Yeah, they have guys that can score.
Yeah. And then Lopez obviously is a better centerpiece, but he's on this minutes limit now. What's the story with that, Bai? Do you have any idea like why they feel like they can only play him for like 27 minutes all of a sudden?
I'll be totally honest. I haven't been as plugged in on them in the last few months for obvious reasons. Now that I'm out here in your neck of the woods, but really ever since Sean Marks took over back in February, they've been very, very cautious with Lopez.
I think that's a smart move.
I think it is too. I mean, I think, you know,
he's their best trade asset.
Yeah, you know, I keep telling people though, like, I really don't think he's ever going to get traded by them. I think it would be smart of them maybe to try to do it, but I think the problem, Nate, is, you know, we're talking now about a minutes limit, right? Like, I think for so many people, they look at Brook Lopez and just say, there's no way I can give you anything for that guy because I don't know if he's ever going to stay healthy. So if you're the Nets, it's like, well, you're not playing for a draft pick anyway. So, like, you might as well just have this good character guy who's a really good player to just start your rebuild around and then kind of do it that way. Because, I mean, to me, what do you think they could get for him? Like a protected first?
Yeah,
like,
that's
not doing them any good at this point.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you would have to really get two first round picks, I think.
If they could get two first for him, I would do it. I just can't see any team doing that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some of these research rich teams, but I think, you know, you look at the Celtics, a team that's trying to contend, they have bigger fish to fry than Lopez. He's not going to put them over the top. So at that point, I mean, maybe if those assets finally start to grow stale and you're encountering drive the new car off the lot syndrome and you feel like they're burning a hole in your pocket, then maybe you make that. But yeah, and you know, he has been really good this year, but he obviously is a guy who can be maybe played off the floor at times too. But yeah, I mean, 26 points in 28 minutes.
Well, if he's going to start shooting threes like this, like that then he becomes a lot different player too.
He's pulling from like 4 feet behind the line.
I know. And the funny thing is, like, Brook has always been able to do that. He just never did. Like, you would watch him, it was kind of like Kevin Garnett. You know, if you ever watch Kevin Garnett warm up, he would drain 23s in a row sometimes, but he would never shoot it in a game. And Brook would go around the arc and shoot threes all the way around. Then during the games, he'd pull up at 18 feet every time.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't playing for the most imaginative of coaches who were ever going to put him in a position.
Well, even if they wanted him to do it, he just didn't ever seem enthused about doing it, right? But again, credit to Kenny Atkinson. He comes in, he says, you're going to shoot threes. And now Brook is shooting threes. And, you know, the benefits are obvious.
Yeah, and we'll get to Minnesota now. But I thought one of their big problems was that Lopez really dominated Karl Towns in the low post. And I think Towns' defense has been one of the big disappointments for me so far in this Minnesota season that looks like it could go off the rails pretty quickly here now at 1-5.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, I've been leading the Wolves bandwagon. And look, I mean, here was my case for the Wolves. They had Tom Thibodeau become the coach, so I thought their defense was going to get demonstrably better. And after, frankly, being coached pretty terribly most of last season and losing a ton of late and close games, I thought with a very good coach, they would be much better in late and close games. Now they've lost 4 late and close games, and their defense has been terrible. And today is the prime example. I mean, like you said, 23 for 32 in the restricted area. I mean, that is a straight shot at your center.
I mean, the Nets took almost half their shots as threes, and they still shot 55% in this game.
Right. I mean, you want to talk about a bad situation. No, and the Nets had 21 turnovers that turned into 27 points off them for the Wolves. Like, I mean, that, you know, even with that, the Wolves still couldn't find a way to win this game. I mean, playing a Nets team without Jeremy Lin, without Grievous Vasquez, playing a rookie at point guard. Like, I know Ricky Rubio is out, but I mean, that's just a very disappointing game.
You were driving the Wolves bandwagon for even 50 wins.
Right.
I had them with 40 this year. Mm-hmm. Now, you've seen how they've been over these first 6 games. Obviously, Rubio has been out with that elbow, and that was one of the reasons I was a little more cautious on them, was that he always seems to miss time.
Yep.
Although that elbow thing is kind of more of a freak injury, but nonetheless. So if you had to recalibrate your expectations for them now, where do you see them?
I mean, the weird thing about them, right? It's like they've had 4 games that were kind of toss-up games that they've lost all of them. And they had big leads in most of them. So I don't know if you probably have to downgrade them at least several wins from where I had them before, just because, you know, like we've said, their defense is not where it should be. And it just doesn't seem like they're a lot better in these late and close games. But I still think they have a lot of talent, and they've shown in spurts that they're capable of playing really well. I mean, we were hanging out watching the first night of games. They were up 20-1, I think, on the Grizzlies within 4 minutes, you know, and then they end up by the end of the first quarter, they're up four. You know, it's like that's kind of been their season. They just have these seesaw runs. You know, they've been terrible in the third quarter. Today they were better, but they've gotten destroyed in the third quarter a lot. I think the Thunder on Saturday had a 20-0 run in the third quarter of their game when they blew them out. Like, I don't know. I mean, maybe you have a better answer than me.
Yeah, well, knowing that Rubio, I mean, we still haven't gotten any kind of prognosis for him. We've seen that, you know, if it's kind of a sprained elbow type of thing, we've seen kind of 2 to 4 weeks for that. Historically, Jimmy Butler had a similar injury in 2014-15. And I think that assuming that he's going to miss time, you know, I'm thinking maybe 35, 37, that they will start to come on down the end of the year. But, you know, you look at this team, we thought that Tibbs could be an immediate miracle worker and maybe they'll come around. But who on this team is a good defensive player is in the rotation right now? I mean, you have guys who just are too young, are not established there enough. You know, LaVine, Chris Dunn, who actually, you know, Tyus Jones took his minutes in this game. Dunn played his first stint and then, you know, never came back in again. And Jones was great. He had 5 steals and 7 assists in this game. Yeah. And actually, you know, they were in the black when Jones played. And a little disturbing considering if he's better than Chris Dunn right now, he's also like 2 years younger than Chris Dunn still. I mean, Dunn still has the upside in terms of his physical capabilities, but, you know, his jumper has looked very, very shaky. Dunn only was able to get one shot off.
Yes.
And then Wiggins, you know, still, he's had a long way to go. And I hope for a little bit more from Towns in terms of his ability to protect the basket. And we have not really seen much of that from him.
Yeah, I feel, am I wrong to think that he's been worse on defense this year?
Well, I think we may have overrated him because of he had some really nice
just how moments. Much of a mess everything else.
No, right. I was going to say because he was really good switching out on the perimeter in a couple of those games against the Warriors. Right. He is good at moving his feet, but just in terms of positioning, actually like getting his body in a position to help on a possession by possession basis. You know, I mean, you don't see him making very many verticality plays with his chest. And then Gorgui Dieng is another guy who, while he has in theory the physical tools as a shot blocker, hasn't really been good. And then he got played off the floor late because they were going with shooting at the four.
Yeah.
And then they had to go with Muhammad actually at the four. And then that's when Towns with 5 fouls was powerless to stop Lopez.
Yeah. And I mean, that's why, I mean, I think you guys said you're okay with that Jang extension and I didn't mind it.
No. I didn't like it.
I couldn't remember, but
I understood the thinking, but I would have waited. And I also thought I would have tried to use his small capital.
Yeah. I just didn't get that. Like, I thought I really like what Minnesota did this summer because they, you know, even if like, you know, I know you guys talked about how Brandon Rush had been terrible and then today he didn't play for Muhammad. So that was a nice step forward, I thought, from Tibbs. But yeah, like giving Jang $16 million a year when I think he's a backup center anyway for starters. And then on top of that, like you're trying to play him with Towns. And I don't really think that's a good idea long term. I know Tibbs likes to play two bigs and that might just be the way they go, but I, you know, today is a perfect example of why I wouldn't be paying him $60 million on a team when you have Karl Towns.
We should leave by talking about Andrew Wiggins, who is on an unbelievable tear.
Yes,
from 3-point range. He was 6 out of 7 in this game. He had 36 points, although it took him 33 shooting possessions to get there, and he was only 13 of 29 despite going 6 out of 7 because he shot the lowest percentage basically on that number of shots that I can ever remember someone shooting at the rim, 2 out of 14.
Hard to do.
And so I went back and watched all those, and it really didn't look like anything that you can put your finger on. He had probably 4 or 5 of those that just like lipped out, missed a couple of dunks. One of them was open. One of them he was trying to dunk on Justin Hamilton and just missed it. Nice play by Hamilton. And then he got stopped by Brook Lopez a couple of times. Brook is a decent rim protector when he's in there, though. He did just get absolutely obliterated by a Towns dunk.
Yes, he did.
At one point.
Yes, he did.
But, you know, he clearly had the last laugh in the game and played better than Towns tonight. So it was... I won't make too much of the fact that Wiggins had this really awful shooting game at the rim. I mean, it's not like a lot of these were plays where he was getting to right there and just, you know, the ball squirted, it came out of his hand wrong and just rimmed out. So I don't make much more of it other than that.
I just feel like that's a good way to sum up the Wolves season so far. Like, they've just had a lot of things happen that don't make a lot of sense. Like that. Like, if you had a guy go to the rim 14 times in a game, so it's basically impossible to go 2 for 14. And... you know, Zach LaVine got a drive late. I want to say it was a 2 or 3 point game. He just whiffs a layup. Like Andrew Wiggins missed three free throws late in this game. He missed free throws late at a couple other games. Like they've just shot themselves in the foot time and time again through these first several games, which is why, you know, I'm not ready to just throw the towel in on them completely. But, you know, it is basically just making me laugh because they're basically just throwing back the reasons why I thought they would be a lot better right in my face right off the bat. So it's been funny.
It's also a little disappointing that they can't get Towns the ball. Like when he is an advantage, he has the advantage against Brook Lopez. Like, yeah, he had to guard Brook, but Brook had to guard him at the 3-point line on the other end. Right. And, you know, I don't know that Towns, he may have gotten one shot in the last 5 minutes of the game while LaVine and Wiggins and LaVine had a chance to tie it out of a sideline out of bounds, took a terrible contested two with about a minute left. That really was, I think, their last chance to get back in the game before the Nets just started hitting free throws late.
Let me ask you about that, because I've been thinking that watching the Pelicans play a lot, because like there was that game, I don't think you ever talked about on the podcast, and maybe you did in the 15 and 60, but that Pelicans Suns game last Friday was just, the overtime of that game was just a complete travesty, and Anthony Davis never touched the ball. You had Lance Stevenson before he got waived just chucking up air balls from 3 and 20 feet, and like what is the way to get these centers the ball in these situations? Like, it just seems like a lot of times these guards just decide they're just not going to pass it to them. And I would just, if I was the coach of these teams, I'd be losing my mind.
Well, Karl Towns against Brook Lopez, you can just bring him off a screen and throw him the ball and let him just go to work.
Right.
You know, one-on-one, and maybe even from the top of the circle and put shooting around him, which they had.
Right.
And see if he can actually just kind of blow by the guy. Those are not.
Right. He should be able to put the ball on the floor and go by Brook at any point.
Yeah. I mean, you don't see teams usually do that for really just like a top of the floor ISO for a guy who's center size or an AD is probably doesn't quite have the ball handling skills or like, you know, the shooting that Towns does. So that's not necessarily the steady diet, but straight post-ups are tough in this day and age. I mean, you talked about that AD game where
he just kept trying to post, like every time down, they'd try to post him up. The guard would look for a half a second, throw the ball back to Lance, and Lance would dribble around and shoot a 20-footer. I was sitting with the Pelican scout in LA. And we were like, come on, like what is happening? What is happening in this game? Like get Anthony the ball. You see it all the time with these big guys where they just don't get the ball enough. And I'm always just kind of amazed that these coaches never find, like they can't figure out a way to get the ball in their hands more.
Yeah, well, I think when the sphincters kind of tighten late, you want to make sure at those times, so a post-entry pass becomes more difficult.
Right.
And teams are switching pick and roll, and then they're fronting. They have their best units in, and I think when you're guarding Towns, the traditional center, putting him in pick and roll, getting a pick and pop, and then have him attack out of that is a good way to go. But you know, the Wolves, I mean, the Wolves weren't getting terrible shots down the end either. As you mentioned, they were getting to the rim a reasonable amount. It wasn't the offense that killed them in this game. It was their defense. But yeah, I mean, that is something to monitor because Towns is clearly a more efficient option than either LaVine or Wiggins in most matchups.
Yeah, no, they're all situations interesting. And I'm curious to see how Tibbs handles this whole thing because, you know, he's not the most patient guy. And I'll be curious to see what happens if this doesn't start to improve soon here, what they do. I mean, it might be smart for them to try to explore trading Rubio and try to get something for him. But, you know, I don't know what the market would be. You know, I'm not sure.
I'd be curious to see. It seems more likely that would happen to me.
You would think, but they also have that. This is also in the one of those situations where you have to coach also as the top executive. And Tibbs isn't exactly a guy who's ready to win 25 games. So, you know, I'm curious to, I'll be very curious to see what they do with that. Cause, you know, to your point, that's what they should do probably. If these struggles go on a bit longer and it looks like they don't really have a shot, then when Ricky gets back, they probably should try to move him to somebody.
Let's get to the Grizzlies and Nuggets now. Tony Allen.
Another game with a bunch of disastrous plays late in it.
Yeah.
Oof.
Tony Allen was out tonight. He had come back from, I think, a knee issue, and now he has a a right groin issue, and you always have to wonder about him, especially with their very limited depth on the wing. But at least they got Parsons back now. He played 20 minutes, looked a little better than he did over the weekend.
Couldn't have looked worse.
Yeah. No, I mean, he didn't have the jumper working, but he was able to get out in transition. He had a couple of nice cuts, actually three of them, one for a dunk and two for layups.
Yep.
Off of nice feeds from Marc Gasol. It looks like they'll have a nice chemistry going. And so if as long as Parsons can get his jumper working, I think he's going to be really helpful. He wasn't quite at the point yet where he's really creating with the ball in his hands, which is something that they really sold him on and want him to do. But, you know, baby steps. And it looks like he's going to be kind of on this 20-minute limit here for at least the next few games as he ramps up.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, we knew at the time when they signed him, right, that Chandler Parsons is exactly what the Grizzlies have needed for years now. You know, he's plus 13 tonight, even with his shooting struggles still. And, you know, the issues with Parsons isn't anything to do with his play. It's if his knees are going to hold up and he can stay on the court. But if he can play, I mean, yeah, he's a perfect fit as a shooter and a ball handler on that team. And, it'll be interesting to see how he fits in with that group if he can stay on the court.
Yeah, although if Vince Carter is going to put up 20 points, maybe he's not as essential.
Where was this Vince last year? Like, he must have just been hurt, right? Like, he looked shot last year. And he's looked great all through these first couple weeks. He's looked like a totally different player again.
Yeah, he shut down Andrew Wiggins in that game on, yep, on opening night that we watched together. And he was 8 out of 13. 3 of 7 for three.
Yeah, he just looks like a totally different guy now. It's amazing. But
5 assists, and you know, I think it's one of those things where, and he played 31 minutes,
right?
And I think they're able to do well with Jamichael Green on the floor. So, I mean, this was an interesting question. Fizdale had admitted in the game against the Blazers that he erred by not bringing Zach Randolph in when the Blazers were going with a smaller lineup and stretching the floor. This time, yep, Zach played a little bit more, didn't do a ton down the stretch. They're kind of going offense, defense with he and Green. But the end of this game really probably deserves like its own special section here.
It was awful. I mean, it was just a whole bunch of mess ups.
The players, it was really...
Yeah, everybody was terrible. Every single person on the court was terrible the last 5 minutes. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, it was... It really, probably where we should start is with what I thought was a really miserable call after a Conley missed jumper where Moutier was called for a charge, barely contacted.
Oh, ridiculous.
Conley, it was a total flop. He wasn't even really going to the basket. Conley did cut him off, but then just, you know, got blown over by a stiff breeze, and they called the offensive foul with 30 seconds left in what was a 1-point lead for the Grizzlies at that point. And so then
we should mention it had been a 1-point lead for 2 minutes because nobody had made a shot in like 6 possessions, just going back and forth and either turning the ball over or missing. I mean, it was just a series of either turnovers or missed shots for 2 minutes from the,
yeah,
2.5 mark down to the point you're referring to.
Yeah, it was a contested three for Moutier. Harris missed like a contested pull-up. He got an offensive foul that was probably more deserved than the one that Moutier got.
Yeah.
So then the Grizzlies, with 29 seconds left, there was plenty of time for the Nuggets to just play defense. They had a foul to give, but you know, you think you just play defense, and then they had a timeout left. They could get the ball back with 5 seconds left.
Right.
Harris got called for another total ticky-tack foul.
Terrible foul trying to go over screen. Ridiculous.
And then you thought it was advantage Grizzlies, but they were still in the penalty. And then the Grizzlies got stripped. Conley, normally reliable, got trapped on the sideline, out of bounds, and probably got fouled. Did you think that was a foul?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, especially like Gary Harris barely touched. I think it was Conley. I don't remember who was on the screen, but then he runs over and just grabs Conley's arm and takes the ball from him. I mean, if you're gonna call the touch on the hip before, I mean, you probably have to call that a foul, I think. You know, him and Moutier both bodied up Conley and took the ball. You know, I mean,
you're usually not going to get called for those type of plays, though. And in the referee's defense, when you have two bodies around someone really trapping them hard,
yep,
it's hard to get an angle behind those bodies. And so it might have just been, and also there's the inbounder there as well. So it may have just been that the referee couldn't get a good enough look at it.
No, and look, and it's like we talked about with the Hawks and Cavs game, right? Like, to the Nuggets' credit, they didn't just run over and like wrap them up, right? Like, they tried to steal the ball and it worked. Like, It's another example of like, go for the steal. And if it takes a couple seconds, like that's probably not going to kill you, especially only down one. And in this case, you know, they got the benefit of knocking the ball away and got a layup.
Yeah, Moutier went in for that. And then the Grizzly advanced the ball and struggled to get the ball in. They were out of timeouts at that point. They had to get it in. Ennis got it cutting to the foul line, and Moutier switched onto him and forced Ennis to just throw this wild left-handed pass out of bounds. And it looked like the game was going to be over then. The Nuggets are up one, inbounding in the front court with only 4 seconds left after they advanced the ball. They used their last timeout as well. And then fantastic Grizzlies defense managed to get a turnover, even with Mike Malone inserting designated inbound man Mike Miller.
It's so great. So great.
And there was actually pretty decent execution by the Nuggets, because what they did was they're switching. And so Jokic, who is huge, I thought that it looked like this was the play. He screened Conley, who's tiny. And if you're doing it right, you can screen a guy. And then if they switch, you have him on your back.
Ball. Yep.
Yeah. And then you can cut right to the ball. But the problem was they had Marc Gasol on Mike Miller. And so Miller had to loft it too high for Jokic, just went over his head, and Conley was able to pick it up. And then he looked like he kicked it out of bounds. They ruled it Nuggets ball, or they ruled it Grizzlies ball. And then the referees changed the timing on it.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, because I went back and watched the end of this game a little later, and I had the sound off because I just didn't want to listen to it as I was going through it. Was there ever an explanation either during the game or after it as to why they added the extra 0.4 seconds?
I guess they felt like it just went out of bounds at that time.
Just went out of bounds earlier? All right. I did think Moutier did graze the ball. It was very hard to tell. But it looked like he might have touched it a little bit, and they did initially rule that it was going to be Grizzlies ball, which might be why they ended up with it, because it was hard to tell. But I just was curious if they had ruled why they gave him the extra 0.4 seconds.
But that was enormous, because with 0.3 you can only go for a tip, and right. While the Grizzlies did end up getting a tip, you deploy your defense completely differently when there's only
right.
a tip. And so Malone brought in Fareed for Jokic, and they were able to set a good screen. Moutier played it as well as he could, and Vince Carter threw an unbelievable pass just over Moutier's fingertips, and Gasol tipped it in and got the buzzer beater. It was just an amazing pass by Carter. I mean, did you see anything that you felt the Nuggets should have done differently on that play? I mean, you always feel bad when you give that up, but I thought it was just a great play.
Yeah, I just thought it was like you said, a lot of times you can kind of nitpick stuff there, and you know, maybe you say, you know, maybe if you had Jokic in there, he gets a hand on the ball or something. I mean,
yeah, but there still would have been a switch. So
right, so it would have been a switch. Either. Right. And look, I to your point, a lot of times in a situation like that, I would prefer to just say, hey, that's a hell of a play by the other team. And that was a picture perfect pass by Vince Carter, and a great play by Gasol to make it. I mean, it's funny because of where we're at. That reminded me of the play the Nets ran against the Warriors.
That's right. Yeah, I thought of that too.
Last year, where Brook Lopez was even closer to the basket than Marc Gasol was. And to this day, I will never know how the shot he took did not go in.
That was your last ever game as Nets beat
writer. That was my last ever game as Nets beat writer. And I was sitting there going, wow, the Nets are going to send me off with a win over the Warriors. I cannot believe this. And then literally right in front of me, right in my sight line, I'll never forget it. Brooke just touched this ball up, and it hit the back of the rim and somehow didn't go down. It was amazing. But
it was an awesome play design, as you mentioned, because they had, I forget who it was, come around, get a screen and come down the middle of the lane first. And that made Danilo Gallinari, who was guarding the inbounder, he backed off a little bit to make sure to cover that.
Yeah, I think Parsons came down the lane, I think.
Yeah. And then they ran another screen to get Gasol in the same action. And while Moutier did well to still be there, he jumped as high as he could and he just couldn't get there. And
right. Yeah.
No. Any Denver thoughts before we move on to the Lakers and Dallas?
I mean, just in a general sense, I think it's very cool that they're playing Jusuf Nurkić and Nikola Jokic together. I think you could have come into this season, and I agreed with your assessment with you and Danny, like you guys both thinking they can be 500, maybe a little better if everything breaks right. Like I'm very bullish on this Nuggets team. I think they have a lot of good players.
Two horrible games, Portland game and now this one. I mean, yes. They could be well over 500.
Yes, agreed. But what I was going to say was I do like the fact that They're saying we're not necessarily trying to win every single game with our most optimal team right away. And, you know, we want to see if we can make this Nurkic and Jokic thing work, because if you can have those two guys play together, that gives you a lot of options going forward. And I do like that they're trying that. And I mean, for me, you know, I know you mentioned, I guess you should say you had it in the notes. I mean, Jamal Murray could score, but play zero D at this point. And I do.
He kind of reminds me of Doug McDermott in some ways, like coach's son.
Wow. That is a cop no one's ever used before.
Well, I mean, he is very, very skilled.
Yeah.
Offensively, like great shooter, you know, knows where to be, great offensive instincts. He was 0-for-3 in the first half, and then he made his all four of his shots in the second half, mm-hmm. and also had some nice drives where he found guys in pick and roll. But he almost just like is so concerned about the fact that he's not able to stop anyone that he almost like spazzes out on defense. And
yeah.
Just like, and every time someone goes at him, he almost like panics and ends up like giving up a pretty good look. Like he definitely has a long, long way to go.
It feels like kind of like Jordan Clarkson to me, right? Like his most likely destiny is as a good six man, where he comes in and scores for you in the second unit, getting under the ball a little bit. Is that fair?
Maybe that's the case. I think he can get better. I think he can be a good team defender. I'm not saying that he has anywhere near the limitations that Doug McDermott has, but just
right.
Just kind of his body language, being a smart player, yet, you know, looking very shaky on defense in that way. It reminded me of just the way Doug looked.
Oh, no, I think it's a really good comp. Murray's kind of a tweener for me, because I don't quite know if he's ever going to be a point guard, and he's a little bit small to be a straight up two. But I know you've liked him going back to the draft, and you know, I like him too. I mean, you know, that Pelicans team we saw last night play against the Warriors could certainly use Jamal Murray. They would be okay. But what I wanted to ask you was, what have you thought? I mean, you talked about Moutier on the pod with Danny. You know, he went crazy the other night in Boston, but I thought he was pretty good again in this game, other than the turnovers. And it does seem like he's at least, you know, at least maybe regressing back towards the mean after a pretty disastrous shooting start for him.
Yeah, he was 7 out of 13 from the field, 8 of 10 from the line, 7 assists, although he did have the 7 turnovers, as you mentioned. And yeah, he looked pretty good, and it was good for him. I think he can be effective against teams that are using a traditional big man at center, and he's starting to learn how to finish around those guys. And it, you know, it wasn't like crazy hot 3-point shooting like it was against the Celtics. So maybe he can do well and really, if not become a star, at least maybe become an above average point guard and become pretty good defensively. We should also would be remiss in not mentioning that Wilson Chandler missed this game due to a hamstring issue. They got Will Barton out, so they really only had one small forward. They're even having to play Juan Hernan Gomez at
right
forward at times. So it was really, and
this is probably the perfect team for that to happen against, though, to be fair. If you're ever going to have a game where you're not going to have enough wings, it's probably against Memphis, that at least among decent teams. So they're probably the best matchup you could ask for in that spot.
Yeah, and Marc Gasol looked good in this one. 30 minutes, 19 points for him, 6 assists. He's been operating out of the high post pretty well, and only took 1-3 in this one. But yeah, I mean, this Grizzlies team lucks into another win, right? Like this,
yeah.
They've got like 3 1-point wins now or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, they're banking wins. And I should say, too, I meant to bring this up. I really like the fact that Fizdale came in right away and you know, got the Zach Randolph off the bench thing to work, because, you know, at this point in his career, Zach, I think, is not quite able to guard most fours, so it's probably not very good to have him in the starting lineup. But he showed in this game again that he's still more than a load on the low block and can really be a nice weapon for them against second units. I mean, tonight he had 16 and 8 in 23 minutes, and I think he could get 12, 14, 16 points a lot of nights, just, you know, catching post-ups 3 feet from the basket against smaller defenders and kind of bullying him inside.
Yeah, 4 offensive rebounds as well. He had some really nice moments on the offensive glass. Even mm-hmm. when they had the two centers in there, he was still able to be pretty effective. And Andrew Harrison went 2 of 4 on threes. He had 10 points, which was, he actually looked like a real player. Granted, he was being guarded by Jamal Murray part of that time. But
10 points, 3 boards, 6 assists, and 4 steals. That's pretty good.
That's like a real NBA player game from a guy who we've we're probably been thinking about his kind of replacement level.
Yeah, agreed. Who knows whether agreed. I saw him in the D League playing against Baron Davis last year and was not very impressed. So, I mean, he was good.
So we rang the alarm bells on the Dallas Mavericks when they dropped to 0-5 and Dirk Nowitzki was going to miss at least like a week trying to get this Achilles thing taken care of. Deron Williams suffered a calf injury. He's going to be out for, I would guess, a while.
Yeah.
Tend to linger. And you know from having covered him that he's not the quickest healer in the world.
He is not the quickest healer. And as you guys talked about the other day, at this point, he's just got muscle injuries all the time. But, Nate, Harry B to the rescue.
How is this first stretch of the season now? It's been 7 games. Barnes is averaging close to 20 a game. He's really been one of the primary offensive forces on this
team. 30-point games after having won his entire career.
Yeah, and that one, I think, was on like the last day of the season in like 2015 when they were resting everybody else, right?
Yes.
So, how much does this change your perception of him? Are you going to start to believe yet? Do you think that this is just, all right, maybe slightly better, and this is just a good run? Like, how sustainable do you think what he's been doing has been?
Well, I don't want to mischaracterize your take on Barnes, but I think we both are more on the high end of what people thought of him even coming into the season, and that, you know, a lot of our friends like Amin Alhassan and Ethan Strauss both, like, will say that he's a terrible player and not good at all. And I've never thought that. Like, I thought Harrison was solid at just about everything, which means he's pretty good, because it's hard to find a combo forward who can effectively guard big power forwards in the post like Harrison can, who can space the floor. Yeah,
we thought he would be a role star, though.
Right. No. I was just saying, like, there's a lot of people who didn't think he was that. So I'm just saying, like, to me, that was kind of the baseline for him. Rick Carlisle is a genius, so I really liked Harrison going to the Mavs, because I thought that if there ever was going to be a coach in a situation where you could kind of unlock the, here's a guy that looks like he should be a great player but hasn't quite activated it, let's put him with this mad scientist coach who tends to get the best out of everybody that comes across. But I would never have guessed he was going to have 30-point games in 7 games.
You would have been surprised if he had that many this whole year.
I don't know. I mean, I think Harrison's a good player. I could see him kind of settling into being a Rudy Gay type forward, which I think is, you know, probably a better player than people would have thought.
Maybe a better spot up guy than Rudy Gay. That's an interesting comparison for him, actually. But I mean, the thing is, he's been efficient. He had his 31, and that was on only 22 shooting possessions.
Yeah, 18 shots, 8 of 9 at the line, hit a 3. I mean, he's been really good.
And he's shown the thing. All right, so there's reasons to believe that this is real. He has looked excellent, just taking guys off the dribble, crossing guys up, finishing at the rim. He's looked better. But mostly I would say his off the dribble game, his ability to attack the basket off the dribble.
Yeah, it looks a lot better.
Has looked better.
Yeah, a lot better. And
now, what's not going to continue is he's 26 out of 54 on twos outside the paint.
Yeah, that seems a little high.
Yeah, so 48% on those. That he would be very, very hard pressed.
League average is about 40 on those, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, he is creating those shots in the half court. That's not bad. And really, I mean, the bigger thing isn't even necessarily what he's been doing himself, but these last two games, they've gone against switching defenses, the Bucks and then the Lakers. And he's actually been good enough one-on-one that he's broken those switching defenses. The Lakers have had a lot of success there. And then down the end of the first half, they were switching to get D'Angelo Russell on Barnes and he couldn't guard him. He got into foul trouble, had to take a seat on the bench. And then they had a couple of other plays too where they got the switch and then they tried to front. Bogut did a great job. They Mozgov came over to the strong side zone, and so Bogut set a screen to the backside and got Seth Curry an open three. But that all started because they got the switch in a 1-4 pick and roll with Barnes playing the four. And then the Lakers, because he'd been scoring, like, had to overreact to what he was doing. And it's pretty remarkable that Harrison Barnes would be the guy to break this defense that had actually been pretty successful through the first few games of the season.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned it before, Nate, but I mean, anybody who had been around the Warriors always would kind of laugh that Harrison just never could really dribble very well. You know, that was kind of one of the things that really held him back in terms of why people didn't think he could really take that next step as a player. And I mean, he had a couple of dribble moves. And in the fourth quarter, I think he scored 7 of his 8 points in the fourth quarter, like right away. He had, I think, 2 or 3 buckets right in a row early in the quarter. And a couple of them were on really nice dribble moves to the rim that you wouldn't have thought he could make before. And, you know, if Carlisle can really unlock that part of Barnes's game, I mean, he had all the tools to do everything else before. So, you know, if that's something that can consistently stick around, then yeah, maybe he is a guy that can average in the low 20s and really be a solid option next to Dirk in the front court.
So the Mavericks, did you know that they had hired God Shamgod as a player development assistant?
I did know that, yes.
And I think like someone was crediting, it might even have been on the broadcast, Barnes's work with him, which I mean, hey, if that's
God Shamgod is a legendary, he is a legendary ball handler from New York. I mean, I'm not even being facetious about that. Like he went to Providence and he was a,
oh yeah, no, I mean, he has a move named after him.
Yeah. I mean, he is a legend. Like I spent a lot of time in New York. He is a street ball legend in New York. You know, people can look up the Shamgod on YouTube if they want to know what we're talking about. But I mean, it would be something if God Shamgod unlocked Harrison Barnes. I mean, quite the story.
Whether that's true or not, I think what is clear is just that he has a lot more confidence. And he knows that when he is unleashed as the guy, they know that he has carte blanche. He obviously failed in that role his second year with the Warriors as a bench scorer that they're trying to go to in ISOs. But now that he has to score, I think a lot of his conscience is removed. And he's a guy who tends to overthink things. And the fact that he can just go out and be aggressive, I think, has been really useful for him.
Huge now, for him.
You know, we could be talking in 2 weeks about how that's over now and he's not hitting any of these shots anymore. And obviously his dribble game is made much more effective by the fact that he's on fire for mid-range right now.
Right.
If he stops hitting those, then maybe it gets a little bit harder for him. I think a couple other things we got to talk about here from the Mavs side too. Seth Curry had a career high 23 points in this one.
I mean,
and you know, hitting threes, he was very effective in pick and roll and just getting some floaters. Kings probably could use someone like him, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I want to say one thing first before I forget. All these things we're going to wind up talking about, all go back to the fact that Rick Carlisle, I think, is the best one game coach in the league. Like, that guy just does an unbelievable job. Whatever you give him 9 or 10 players, he'll figure out a way to make them all be as useful as possible in a given night. I mean, they played 8 guys today, and you know he found a way to maximize all of them, and it's just incredibly impressive. But to your Curry point, I mean, I was watching him in the fourth quarter and just thinking, you know, man, like, you know, the Kings team that, you know, they just had Darren Collison out with the suspension, and you know, Ty Lawson and Garrett Temple running the point. And like, Seth Curry could have been playing 36 minutes a night for them for the last 2 weeks, and they might have an extra win or two.
Yeah, and he still would be a better backup point guard option.
Oh, for sure.
Assuming that Collison is the starter.
He might even be a better starting point guard option than Collison, really.
Maybe. I'm not sure about that. I think he could be. He definitely had some trouble with fouling in his first few games.
Yes.
I think he's gotten past that a little bit now. But yeah, he played 31 minutes in this one.
Plus 22.
That's good. Yeah, and Bogut, while he has been off and on and, again, did not close this game, he did play 29 minutes, managed to stay out of foul trouble. He still can't score at all. He was 1 out of 5. His post-ups get, you know, uglier and uglier every year. And really, he's never been the same on that score since injuring the elbow. But he does... He's probably craftier than just about any setter in the league, and informed by his time in Golden State. Like, I referenced that one play where he wasn't getting guarded, and so he just went and set a screen instead for a shooter. And so he is, if anyone can mitigate the fact that he doesn't need to be guarded, it's Bogut with his screen setting. And he was very good in this one. He had 2 blocks as well, and was plus 20 in his 29 minutes.
Yeah, I love watching Bogut play. I know he frustrated a lot of people in Golden State because he would sometimes be in and out and would ha- he'd go, you know, I mean, you had a kind of a running tally on, you know, the amount, the months that was between he had the good games he had on the road last year. But I just, like, to your point about him being crafty, I've always had a thing for, you know, anybody that kind of knows some of the dark arts of the game and how to, you know, do some of the stuff that people don't necessarily notice as much. And Bogut's just a really smart player. I think
you practiced
player.
Some of those dark arts on me the last time we played pickup, by the way.
Just because you were beating the crap out of me, probably. To be fair,
that's actually the last time I played was like during the
final. Oh, me too. I know it's been way too long.
But fortunately, with now that I got this bet with Danny, I'm going to lose some weight and hopefully my knees will cooperate a little bit more. From the Lakers side, Nick Young, I think, scored the first 11 points of the game, which was pretty remarkable, and he had 20 points on only...
the Nick Young resurgence continues.
Only 13 shooting possessions.
Yeah.
And he was probably their best defensive option, did the best job out of anyone they had on Barnes.
Speaking of coaches getting stuff out of players, I mean, I wrote a column about the Lakers today after talking to Luke and Mitch Kupchak and some other people last week, and I mean, look, Nick Young was going to get cut in October. Like, they were going to cut him. And instead, they gave him a chance in a preseason game when they need to rest some guys. And Luke said, look, Nick, I watched you defend when I was an analyst here, and I know you can do it. So if you want to play, go do it. And to Nick Young's credit, amazingly, he's now gone out and, you know, he's working his tail off on defense, and the results are showing.
He's starting.
He's been very good.
I mean, we'll see whether his shooting and efficiency holds up. He's never been able to maintain that, but, you know, it's been a while since he's played in kind of an egalitarian system like this too. He was just asked to create his own shot.
Yep.
He was playing under Byron Scott. And this Lakers team is really interesting. I mean, nobody is really averaging, I think, 30 minutes for the entire season. They missed Larry Nance in this one. I thought that they really got out-hustled.
I like Nance a lot as like a energy big. I mean, he's a fun player.
Dang has continued to struggle, though. He did play 30 minutes in this one, but he was 1 out of 5 and wasn't really able to be successful as the stopper.
I have a theory on that.
Yeah.
He was awesome when he switched to power forward last year in Miami, I thought. And I think part of the problem he's having now is he's basically having to play the 3 full time. I think
you're right about that.
That was kind of the reason I was concerned about his fit there from the start, was that you had Julius Randle, who, while he's quicker, he can't really shoot, so he has to play the 4. You had Brandon Ingram, who eventually they're going to want to play the 4, ideally. And I look at Dang, and I would have much rather he, you know, obviously, look, he got a great contract from the Lakers. It made sense for him to sign there. But I thought if the Lakers are going to go out and sign somebody, they needed to go sign a guy like Harrison Barnes, maybe. That's more of an actual 3. Because I think at this point, Dang it, like Joe Johnson in Utah is best playing the 4. And if he's never going to play the 4 for the Lakers, I have a feeling we're going to probably see, you know, a fair number of nights like this where he struggles.
Yeah, on the season, he is shooting 34%, 21 out of 61. And not really getting that many shots and not making them. That's always a bad combination.
That's not great.
and 31% from 3, a third of his shots have been 3s so far.
Him and Mozgov have combined 6 points and 7 rebounds tonight in 50 minutes. Not ideal.
Mozgov actually hasn't looked bad when he's been out
bad.
There.
They just don't play him a lot.
They've just gone away from traditional bigs, and they've been playing Black a lot. They even played like Black and Thomas Robinson together for a time in the second quarter tonight, which actually, you know, didn't go horribly. But yeah, any other thoughts on the Lakers before we wrap up here?
No, I mean, I think that kind of covers it. I'm still kind of confused as to what Julius Randle is. You know, I kind of feel like he's just a bulkier version of Thad Young. But I know people in LA probably will be angry to hear that, but because he's kind of become one of the quote unquote core guys for them going forward. But
well, I mean, if he looks like he's going to be an adequate starter at this point.
He's just an odd player. Like, you know, tonight he had, you know, 15 and 10, but they needed one assist and six turnovers in 30 minutes. And he can't really shoot. I mean, it's just, he's just an odd guy to figure out. Like, I should say, Walton has said that he's showing him clips of Draymond Green. And I do like that he's doing that. I don't think Julius Randle's ever going to become as good as Draymond Green. But if for no other reason, and if you could get into Julius's head to pass the ball more and play more like Green, I think that would help his game a lot.
He's had some high assist games. And yes, we talked about that that play he had against Phoenix at the end, too, where he made a great pass. And I think the biggest thing for Julius right now is he's shooting 78% at the rim. I don't know if that's an artifact of the fact that the floor is better space. He did not shoot well at the rim last year. And he's even shooting 7 out of 13 for mid-range. And so that's, if he can actually make that shot,
that would help a lot.
Half of a threat, because he shot like 22% from mid-range last year.
That would be huge for him if he could do that.
So I think he's not going to continue to be this efficient. He's at 58% overall on the season. But I think also just if he can hold up defensively, switching in these small lineups down the end of games, like that can be valuable. He's never going to be a shot blocker, but I think what he can do just switching and moving his feet defensively.
Oh, it'd be huge. Could help a lot. And it, I guess since we're talking about the Lakers, you know, people are going to want to know, like, what have you thought so far of their other two, you know, core guys, Russell and Ingram?
Yeah, I mean, you could even throw Clarkson into that mix, too. He's been playing well. I think Ingram has been ahead of where I thought he would be after summer league. He's gotten to close some of these games. He's enough of a threat from three that you have to guard him. And I think his defense has been better than I thought it would be at this point. I think he's been relatively effective. Still a little skinny. Still has trouble like getting down deep into a stance, as a lot of guys do with that body type early in their careers. You know, he's really just got to like strengthen up his glutes and get a stronger core to really slide his feet and dig down deep. But I think I've been impressed by him. He's got some nice playmaking ability. He's hit some contested jumpers. So I think he's maybe, if not looking like an absolute superstar, he looks like he's on schedule. And then Russell has had moments, but Danny and I talked about him a little bit on the 15 and 60, so I won't repeat that too much. But I think he's got to find a way to either be a little bit better distributor. He has great vision, but to actually like get some assists, and he's got to either get to the foul line or figure out a way to score a little bit at the rim, or he's going to have to shoot, you know, 42% on three pointers to be the type of guy that I think a lot of Laker fans think he can be, which is, you know, a top 10 point guard in the NBA. And his defense is still really bad. Like down the end of this game, for example, I don't know whether he was tired or what, but he gave up the icing three to JJ Barea when he just like, he couldn't even get into a stance. He was just bent over at the waist, basically with his legs straight, and Barea just cooked him in a pick and roll and got a wide open three to end the game. So he's got a long way to go defensively as well, especially if he's going to be the primary guy at the point of attack against pick and rolls.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. And I think it is always dangerous to not say that a Laker guy is going to be one of the three best players in the league, because then you have the internet after you. But I think that
this is the one night, actually, I think we don't have to worry about that.
Well, on the one hand, maybe. On the other hand, maybe people will be angrier than ever. But I think that's a very fair assessment, in particular of Russell. He shows flashes to me, but I'm with you. I still think he has to do a lot to try to get to where he can be in that top 10 point guard discussion. But the Lakers are fun. I mean, that's you know, as now I'm on the West Coast, you know, you're always lamenting how you want these late games to be fun. And, you know, the Lakers look like they're going to be an entertaining team this season, which is good for the league. Like, they've got fun young players and they play a fun style of ball, and that's good. Like, the more teams are fun to watch, the better.
And again, for these games too.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
And I do think we didn't, even though we said it, that both Byron Scott and Kobe were just so damaging last year, we probably still didn't even price in enough.
No,
how damaging they were into like
just being around that team. It was remarkable. I mean, you could see it on TV, but being around that team on Friday, it's remarkable just how much different the energy and the mood is around that team. Like it's night and day. It's just, it's a totally different feeling now.
Well, so same question for you about the Lakers as for the Wolves after, I think they're 3-4 now after these
4-4.
Four and four. Thank you. Yeah, that's right. They won the other night.
Yep.
Against Phoenix. So they're 4-4 now. They've had some pretty decent wins. I think their schedule's been about average from what I can recall. Where do you see them finishing now? I mean, I had predicted them being under 24 wins, mostly because of the fact that they have to keep this top three protected pick. But you know, I'm starting to feel better about them than that now. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm torn because I still wouldn't be surprised if they ended up with 22 or 23 wins because they are playing all these young guys. And like you said, I think later in the season, I wouldn't be surprised if there's some creative accounting in terms of trying to make sure, you know, maybe they, you know, sit guys like Mozgov and play Zubac for a while and like try to do some stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, if they got to somewhere in the high 20s, I wouldn't be totally surprised. I think.
Would you put 30 still out of the realm of possibility?
I think that's probably the high end. Like I think if they play through the tape, you know, if they run through the tape, I think 30 is possible. But I'd be kind of surprised over the course of the season if they still got to that point. I mean, I think they still have a long ways to go, but I mean, who knows? You know, it's like I was saying before about the Nets, like if you're playing 10, 11 guys a night, like Luke is, and you have guys buying into what you're doing and they're busting their tail every day for you. Like, it's kind of like when the Celtics that first year under Brad Stevens, I don't remember how many games they won, but they had a bunch of pretty bad players, but they just played super hard every night and were well coached. And so they won more games than they should have. And I could see this Laker team kind of falling into a similar thing where maybe they get to 29 or 30 wins because they just kind of, you know, work their way to 8 or 10 or 12 of them that were surprised they would get.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're going to be in most games at home for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
With that home crowd and young guys playing with a lot of energy, I would expect that to be the case. I mean, they're even after tonight, they have an even net rating. They've played some pretty good teams. They beat maybe probably two of the best four or five teams in the league, at least by their performance so far. So I think maybe it could be higher. I'm not going to rule out getting into the 30s in wins at this point because they've played at that level so far. I do expect some regression to
right
what our preseason expectations were, but I do recalibrate. I mean, I think they're going to get, and it may be a bad thing for the franchise in the long term. Maybe they'll luck into the top three again via the lottery, but you know, if they are not going to be one of the three worst teams in the league, they could end up losing that pick, and they do, I think, need one more guy still on the wing or
yeah. I think I agree with you, but at the same time, I also don't know if it's not the worst thing for as terrible as this as the feelings have been around that team. Like, obviously I think they'd rather have the pick, but if they do wind up winning 31 or 32 games and they don't keep the pick, I think that also might not be a terrible outcome for them, just because that would really give them some nice momentum going forward, which I think
nice enough for Jim Buss to keep his job.
Well,
that's an interesting question.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that whole situation is going to be fascinating. I mean, I've been saying for over a year that I think Phil Jackson is going to wind up back with the Lakers, but regardless of what happens with that stuff, I just, you know, at some point they needed to wash the stench of these last couple of years off of them. And, you know, I think if they do wind up outperforming expectations a little bit and not keeping that pick, you know, at least being able to finally start to move forward as a team is a nice, is a nice counterbalance to not keeping the pick.
All right, let's wrap this up there. Thanks so much for coming on at 2:05 AM. If you care to plug anything, please do so at your leisure.
Well, first off, thanks for having me. It's always fun to talk Hoos with you. And I got my own podcast, Boston Up Podcast. I'll start pumping out some more of those soon. And you can follow my work at the Washington Post, and subscribe to my newsletter, I guess. Putting out a newsletter every Monday, subscribe to that. Check my Twitter feed and find the link for that. So check that out too. But that's about it, I guess. And thanks. It's always fun to talk hoops, Nate. So thanks for inviting me.
All right, man. It's been a long night, but hopefully we will have basketball as this welcome distraction.
That's right.
On Twitter, at Nate Duncan NBA. And I'm just going to say a few words about the election after we let Tim go. So if you don't care to hear that, please turn off now. If you do, stay tuned. I'll be back in a second. So I was doing my normal live tweeting of the games tonight, obviously with one eye on the election results, and I got not that many, but a few tweets basically saying, how can you be tweeting about NBA basketball during this time? And I certainly had those emotions as well, but my response to those people was, look, you're going to go to work tomorrow, and that's what I'm doing. I'm doing the job that I'm doing that I like to do is frankly a welcome distraction for me, and this is what I'm going to keep doing. This is my living. I'm not going to put it on hold, and thank you for everyone who sent supportive tweets. tweets saying that they appreciated it. That was the vast majority of people. And it was good to know that you're still appreciating my work, even though for a lot of us, me included, we're very, very unhappy with the results of the election. And the reality is that given the demographics of people who watch the NBA, that's mostly people living in urban areas who are younger, and then certainly this podcast even more, most people were certainly vehemently anti-Trump. And I'd be lying if I said that I wasn't really depressed with what the results were tonight. But I'm an American. I'm not going to be moving to Canada. I think that that's ridiculous. Like, this is my country, and we have a lot of problems, perhaps starting with the fact that both the Senate and the Electoral College, and to some degree even the House, are extremely undemocratic institutions in the fact that they don't represent the will of the people. But almost half of the people in this country that I love wanted Donald Trump to be their president, including some people who are very close to me. And the truth of the matter is, this is not a political podcast. And I hope that this can still be a place for people, no matter what their political affiliation is, to come together and enjoy the great game of basketball and to get away from some of the more difficult things that all of us have to face in our lives, whether it's politics or otherwise. And having one more thing in our lives that's going to polarize people isn't going to help anything. So I'm just going to try to do my work and do my job and bring you the same coverage that we've always brought you as long as I can. Talk to y'all next time.